listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. My co-host, Dr. Melody Fox, is tending to her practice today, so unfortunately she will not be with us. But don't worry, we're still going to have a great show. Our guest today brings with him an incredible amount of energy wherever he goes. Now, our topic today isn't all that comfortable to look at, but when dealt with, really helps clear a path to success. Our topic today involves excuses or blaming. So be honest, okay? Now, you know, almost all of us are guilty of playing the blame game at some point in our life. And unfortunately, as a culture, we've seen it grow to almost epidemic proportions. Now, I mean, if you think about it, okay, for those of us at work, okay, if we aren't moving up fast enough at work, we can blame the manager or we can blame the whole organization for its inability to recognize our personal genius. Or if it's our personal life and if we're having problems there, if our personal life is just really in a disaster right now, a lot of us will tend to blame our spouses, we'll blame our partners, we can blame the economy, we can even blame our ancestors if we need to. So, you know, it is one of those things that unfortunately a lot of people do. Now, what we want to touch on are more principles of personal empowerment. And if you think about it, while the principles of personal empowerment and accountability are really well known, I think we've done a good job as a society to really get that information out there. Unfortunately, it's difficult for most of us to turn this type of understanding into action. Our guest today strives to change that by showing us how to replace "it's not my fault" with "it's my responsibility," and he does it with conviction. Our guest today, Jim Mr. Energy Smith, is president and CEO of Jimpack Enterprises. He is an internationally known empowerment and motivational speaker, trainer, and coach who has transformed the lives of thousands of people across the world. Jim is the best-selling author of From Average to Awesome, Lessons for Living an Extraordinary Life, Crash and Learn, 600-plus road-tested tips to keep audiences fired up and engaged, and the co-author of The Masters of Success, of which he co-authored with Ken Blanchard, Jeff Canfield, and others. Now, Jim's newest book, the subject of our show today, The No Excuse Guide to Success, provides valuable insights into ways to create positive outcomes through ownership and personal accountability. For over 27 years, Jim has developed creative, inspirational, and high-energy approaches towards creating organizational and individual performance breakthroughs. Jim, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Alan, thank you. Thank you. That was awesome. Awesome. I'm honored to be on the show.
Well, I was very happy to be able to read your book, and it got me fired up. So,
good job.
And I figured if the book can get me fired up, I can imagine what being able to go to one of your seminars or be involved in one of your empowerment programs would be.
Well, Alan, I tell folks at the outset that I will know if I've done my job if the folks in the audience are as tired and as inspired as I am when the session is over.
That's great. So in other words, it's a matter of just taking you to such levels of excitement that when it's all over, you just want to sit down and rest because you feel like you've really done everything you could at that moment?
Alan, you have to. We go to these sessions or workshops. A workshop is not a sit shop. It's a workshop. You come to work. So I'm very experiential. Get people involved. I say people come into the sessions as human beings, but during the course of the session, I turn them into human doings. We get involved full out, all in. That's my approach.
I love it. Now, from the standpoint of doing, let's jump right in regards to the book. One of the things that I like the most is that it just seems like we are bombarded. We're bombarded on television with political ads and everything else. Everything seems to drop to a point in which it becomes a blame game. How do we get out of the cycle of being sucked into this blame game?
for me, the number one way to get out of it is to shift our mindset. Shift our mindset where we believe in total accountability, responsibility. I love the old quote. It came out years ago, but it stuck with me. I think I read it initially in the 80s, but it's, if it has to be, it's up to me. I remember seeing a poster with a couple of mountain climbers climbing up the mountain, and below was the caption, if it is to be, it's up to me. So if that's our mindset, if that's our belief set, if we expect to take total responsibility and ownership, that's a big step toward making that shift to taking personal responsibility and accountability for our goals, actions, behaviors, and thoughts.
Okay, now what about the situations to where we, and I was just listening to it this morning as I was on the drive into the studio. They were talking about a professional baseball player that just recently tested positive for steroids. And and there was one, there were two announcers on the show, and one of them said, you know, I just want everybody to know how much I appreciate and respect this person, because as soon as he was, quote, caught, he said, you know, I'm going to take responsibility for this. I did this. Nobody else did this for me. I take full responsibility and accept my punishment. And so one guy was saying, you know, one announcer was saying, you know, I really respect this guy for doing this. And the other guy had just the opposite, which was, you know what? That's a crock of shit. He said, the bottom line is that this guy has been cheating, and it doesn't all of a sudden, I'm not all of a sudden going to start respecting this person because of the fact that he has now got caught cheating at something. It isn't enough to just take that. Now, what would you, what's your comments in regards to that type of situation?
Great, great question. I think it's and both. Milky Cabrera, I'm a major baseball fan, so I've been following along. And he did do what most don't do, the mea culpa. My fault, my bad, I did it, I'm sorry. I think if he would have got on his knees and cried, then that may have created more of an initial don't worry about it. But when emotion is involved, when money is involved, when the stakes are high, the apology for some is not enough initially. I would much rather that he did what he did than to say, if I would have known this would have hurt you, or if all those things, if I would have known, if I had said that, that would have made you, all those weak qualifying ways of apologizing, I would have been a little more disappointed. We don't know what's inside of him. A lot of people don't come forward until they're caught. The husband who has cheated on his wife and says, baby, 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 I'm sorry, I didn't mean it, but doesn't come forward until he's caught. You know, all those circumstances are different, but I would much rather hear the person say, my bad, I am going to pay for this, I am sorry, it's my responsibility, and whatever happens to me, I'm willing to take it because of the stupid thing I did.
Yeah, and yeah, and in fact, and another point that was brought up during that same interview was, you know, I would rather hear that than to hear somebody say, well, You know the FedEx guy must have mistake, you know, must have mixed
right
up the thing, or you know, or my third cousin once removed, you know, gave me something and told me it wasn't it, and I'm not smart enough to, you know, to at least know what I'm putting in my body. You know, I mean, all of those other things, that gets old. I mean, that gets really old fast.
Yeah, the focus is on the behavior. When we start questioning the individual for who they are, you cannot prove who I am, but you can prove that my behavior was unfathomable. I remember when Don Imus called the Rutgers basketball team, the women's basketball team, nappy-headed hoes. Or I remember when someone else said something that was inappropriate, and they would say, well, I'm not a racist, or my best friends are this and that. I'm not questioning who your friends are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not questioning whether you're a racist or not. I'm calling you on what you said. So when the focus is on behavior or what the person did, we can be a lot more thorough in our investigation and asking for and demanding an answer and an apology.
Absolutely.
So for Milky to say, I was wrong, obvious, and then with more details coming out that he was in the process of putting together a phony website to highlight another drug that he could have been taking that was not.
Yeah.
I'm just glad he said, I'm sorry, I cost my team 50 games, he cost himself zillions of dollars because he's a free agent, and when you take responsibility, you're taking advantage or you're taking responsibility for the good things that come your way as well as the negative or constructive things.
Well, and you just touched on something that I know you also touch on in the book, and that is taking credit. Where is this fine line? You have the whole blame game, but you also have the other part of taking credit. Some people tend to want to go a little too far on that.
Yeah, we supersize the credit because we want to get elevated. I believe your performance and work should speak for itself, and at times it doesn't. So when you're in business or when you're in professionalism and part of people, exposure is so key. So you can create strong exposure opportunities or growing your brand, then to me that helps elevate the credit more so than I did this. It's a fine line. But to me, it's a feeling. It's something that I have internally. And I can feel when I'm speaking, the speakers we're taught do not egregiously sell from the platform. But you also have to let people know about your DVDs and your books and your CDs. You have to do that without selling. And we're schooled and we're taught ways to make that happen without turning people off, and people get quickly turned off. So, yes, you want to take responsibility. You do want to take credit. But in the book I highlight, do it out of love for the person. Do it just to be doing it. Don't do it for the blast on Twitter or the blast on Facebook. Do it because it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely. And I think another thing as it relates to taking credit is there are other people around you. There are other people that, that are affected by what it is that you're doing. If the opportunity is there, let them tell the story.
Absolutely. When I'm doing sessions and I move into talking about an experience, and if someone else was there and I see their hand go up, let's hear your view. What happened? You know, turning people on or giving them the mic metaphorically is a lot better than you recounting everything you've done all the time.
Exactly, because in the bottom line, it's how it affects them that is what makes it a success. You know, you can
how they receive the package.
Exactly.
How they receive the gift.
Mm-hmm. So let me go back to the book for just a moment, because there's a lot of things that I was really interested in, but one of the things was that, and again, for anybody out there in regards to the book, in fact, you know, that's one of the things that's very interactive in regards to, you know, to this show. So for those of you, if you're sitting at your desk, there's no reason why you can't open up another screen. You can open up another screen. You can go to www.noexcuseguide.com and you can see exactly what it is that we're talking about. And one of the things is you define success. Define it as it pertains to what you hope the readers are going to achieve by reading this book.
I would like people to define success and believe that success is something that's within. It's not a title. It's not a class. It's not an income level. It's a place of happiness, joy, peace one has within him or herself. It's doing those things that bring you joy and bring you happiness. It's not a job. It's joy. It's not a paycheck. It's passion. It's feeling good about it. It's creating incredible outcomes every day. It's doing the impossible, and it's doing it with a smile and getting rid of the box and not saying, well, I think outside the box, because when I hear that, I say, so what? Live outside the box. Parent outside the box. Perform outside the box. Work out outside the box. Live a life where you feel, yes, I'm doing what I want to do and I love it. To me, that's success.
Absolutely. And another point that you bring up in the book is that part of success is your own choices and owning your own choices. Now, one of the things that I loved and that I read was you had 10 stops and starts to owning your own choices. And I saw that as a really good beginning to the whole process that you have in the book, which is if you can't get down some of these stops and starts in regards to owning your own choices, you're going to have trouble reaching some of the goals that you really want to get to.
Well, that's why that was the first chapter, really, owning your choices. I wanted to call it owning your stuff, but my publisher said let's be a little more formal. But when we own our choices, own our actions, and oftentimes we quickly move to, well, I made a mistake. Well, in the elevator of life, the first floor is the choice. That choice may turn into a mistake, but people take the elevator that zooms right by the choice and say, oh, I didn't mean that, I made a mistake. Well, there's some accountability there. You chose to do that. And if we start owning our choices, knowing that we choose to stay in this dead-end job, and don't give me that crap about there's no jobs out there. Well, you're not looking for jobs, plural. You're looking for a job or a joy, and you choose to be there. You choose to drive through the red light. You choose not to pay your taxes on time. You choose not to tell your wife you love her every day. You choose, you choose, you choose. Mm-hmm. And we can't blame other people because that's giving your power away. You know, when someone says, you make me so mad, no, you chose to get mad. You could have chosen not to. So that first chapter is about what we can do, some starts and stops for owning our stuff or owning our choices and moving forward. And initially, you had also said about when I speak, the interactive approach that I have. Well, that's my brand, and the book is the same thing. The book is very, you're not going to just read it and put it down. We ask you to do some things. We ask you to record, to write, so there's a certain level of sustainability and where you can go back and see how well you're doing since you said you were going to do this or that.
Mm-hmm. Now, and you mentioned in regards to a job, and obviously in this economy, it's a huge issue right now in regards to unemployment. And it really reminded me of a story that I heard some time ago that stuck with me. And again, it goes back to making choices. And it talks about the percentages of people that truly have the opportunity to get a job. And they say if you have this particular job that's available, they said there's a certain amount of people that are not going to fill out all of the paperwork properly, and they're not even going to be considered. Again,
sure.
That's a choice that they made. So now they didn't even get in, and so whatever that percentage was. And then there's another percentage of people that are not going to follow up when the people say, after you send this in, follow up with a phone call. There's a certain percentage that aren't going to follow up. You made that choice. And then there's a certain percentage that are going to miss their appointment because they either didn't have enough gas in the car, they got a flat tire, but you remember those 17 different times in which you looked at the tires and thought, you know, I should probably replace those. You made a choice that you didn't.
Absolutely.
You know, so those are the things that when people say, like you said, I can't get a job or whatever, you're not really going up against as many people as you think you are if you're the person that makes all of those choices to follow through to try to get what you really want.
And you know, Alan, I am not the person that those people would want to talk to. Because I believe if you do what you love and you become invaluable, opportunities are going to find you. I don't care what it is. We have people now who are bloggers who blog for people and get paid to do it. We have people who return people's emails. They get paid to do it. I mean, if you are good at something and you let people know and you create value and energy, the world we live in right now is so unconventional. It wants difference makers. So if you're using, I don't know if you golf or not, but if you're using the same club for all 18 holes, you're not going to get a good score. You got to have variety, difference. This happened to me a couple days ago. We'll see what happens. I'm driving. My wife and family were in the car, and we come to a red light. There is a gentleman who is, I guess you would call, a beggar, and he has a sign asking for money. I see that all the time in Philadelphia, but he was different. What made him different? His sign says, I need money or a miracle. I cracked up. I said, I love it. That's so creative. Money or a miracle. I rolled my window down. I gave him a copy of the book. I said, here's your miracle. You read this. You follow up with me, and let's see what happens. So now the ball's in his court. And I'm telling you, if he reads it and he follows up with me, I'm going to meet him for lunch somewhere, and we're going to talk about creating more miracles for him. I put the ball in his court. I love his line, money or a miracle. It wasn't just pay me my money or give me any. It wasn't the typical traditional stuff we see. The world doesn't want traditional, typical stuff. It wants a difference because we're living in a new normal.
Well, first I got to tell you, I love that. And I love your response. Not only the sign, but I love your response to it. Again, you put it in his court. You gave him a tool. Now is he going to take it and run with that tool? And it also reminds me, I just got back from vacation, and I saw somebody with a sign that that cracked me up. It didn't have the same effect, but the person had a sign that said, you know, need money, you know, great big words, need money, and then below it it said, and I'm not going to lie to you, I'm going to go get a beer.
Now, see, that sign would get him some interest because people would laugh and say, come on, let's go do this beer. Authenticity. Oh, wow. I love it. I love it. We are afraid. Not, gosh, Alan, I talk about being afraid to lose. We're also afraid to win. We're afraid to be vulnerable and transparent and authentic. And when we start doing that, we move away from excuses. Because everyone else plays it safe.
Well, and I think you're really tying into another point in your book, which is uncertainty. I mean, you know, really, I think what it is that, you know, it's uncertain out there now. And I know you touch on it in the book, but share with some of our listeners, I mean, what are some of the methods for us to use and to embrace in uncertainty rather than just avoid it?
All right. Well, one of the first things, again, goes back to the mindset. We have to learn to embrace, to hold, to hug, to want uncertainty, to want vulnerability, to want fear, because it's when I'm at my best when I don't know what the score is going to be. You know, Dr. Phil likes to say, how's that working for you? A lot of us know how that's working for us, and it's not. Uh-huh. But we would rather stay in that discomfort, stay in that pain, than move toward an uncertain future. People think being vulnerable is weak. Being vulnerable is strong. It's putting it all out there. So again, going back to our mindset, I tell people that thoughts become things. What you think about, you be about. So if you're thinking that the boogeyman's going to get you, well, guess what? The boogeyman's going to get you. When you're thinking this is going to be a lousy day, it's going to be a lousy day. When you start thinking, I think they call it the law of attraction, ask, believe, receive. If you start thinking positive, if you start thinking good, if you start thinking productive about entertaining these actions or these exercises or these job opportunities that we haven't had in the past, your life is going to change. I can't get too negative. When people bring me pity parties, I tell them once, I'll listen to your pity party once, but I don't do reruns. So if you come back to me again, you're going to tell me what you've done about it. Uncertainty increases the likelihood for success. Go for it. And that's what I tell people. And in the book, one of the opening stories, Alan, is when I was in China, and I met Alex, and my course, I do a two-week leadership course for the Rutgers University Executive MBA program, and I probably have the easiest course in the world because the course is on leadership, executive presentation skills, and personal power, knowing oneself. 50% of your grade is just participating in class. That means in conversation, comments, group work, as well as standing up and making presentations on what we reviewed. 40% is your final grade, which is a group project, and 10% is just coming to class. So in my class, you have tons of opportunities to stand up and speak. And I was there for 2 weeks. Day four rolled around, and it's in China. People think all the students are Chinese. They're not. I would say Chinese folks made up maybe 40%, but we had another 50, 60 countries represented.
Wow.
Day four rolls around, we're finishing class, and one of the students raises his hand and says, "Professor, the class is going well. I'm enjoying hearing from folks, but I've got to tell you, I'm disappointed. I haven't heard anything from any of the Chinese students. They haven't said anything." And these are people who I'd say average age is 28, so I'm going 28 through 40, people who are already in the workforce, doing well for themselves, who want an executive MBA. I said to the students, "Okay, you heard the challenge. We'll see what happens tomorrow." Next day rolls around. I'm going through what we're going to discuss, the lesson plan, and a hand went up in the air. It was Alex, one of the Chinese female students. The assignment she took on was to make a 5-minute presentation on the best leadership presentation she ever made or the best leadership presentation she ever saw. Throughout the course of the first 4 days, Alex did not say anything. I barely knew she was in the room. She stood up. She came to the front of the room. She took the handheld mic. And for the next 5 minutes, you would have thought she had gone to the Dale Carnegie School of Presenting, the National Speakers Association, Toastmasters. Girlfriend was on fire. Eye contact, eye communication, told stories, worked the room up and down. I'm on the side having a tissue issue, crying like, "This is Alex. This girl is awesome." The class at the very end is saying, "Alex, Alex." She finished. Everybody claps, standing ovation. Hour later, we take our break. I'm out in the break room. Alex makes a beeline over to me. I gave her a high five. I said, "Who are you and where did Alex go?" And she started laughing. I said, what happened? "Professor, Chinese people aren't raised to be extroverts. They aren't raised to stand up and speak out. I let my ethnicity get in the way, and I have been throughout my life. You helped me see that." I said, "No, Alex, you chose to do it this time." Mm-hmm. "You could have been doing that your entire life. You felt the fear, and you did it anyway. And you're good at it. So I encourage you in your life, when you feel the fear, do it anyway, and you did a phenomenal job. And I'm going to write about this in my book whenever I get it done, so it's done." But we often use ethnicity, we use race, we use age, we use education, we use all these disclaimers to stay in our box. And Alex jumped out.
All right. Yes, and I got to tell you, when you mentioned about the tear, I almost had a tear when I read it in the book as well. Mm-hmm. All right. We are talking with Jim Smith, Jr. The book is The No Excuse Guide to Success, and you have no excuse to hang with us. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. All right, we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. The subject today is the No Excuse Guide to Success. We are speaking with Jim, Mr. Energy Smith. And Jim, we've got a listener question that is coming across. I'd love to share it with you. This one is, it says, "What a great topic. As a counselor at a Utah therapeutic center for teen boys, I spend so much time working with young people who have no concept of responsibility or accountability. In my opinion, it cuts to the heart of why many of these kids are in our care. I am definitely getting the book, but it is a suitable read for the teens as well. Also, are there any techniques in the book that you believe would be useful in my work?"
Absolutely. As you were reading, I'm going to be in Salt Lake City next week working with an organization for the entire week, so maybe we can connect with each other live. But I was thinking about the chapter that's on right fighting, and it talks about the desire to be right. Not to listen, not to learn, not to understand or be understood. It's our constant desire to control every situation. And I find that, you know, at least when I was growing up, I'm 51 now, when elders spoke, I listened. When I was in a room with people who had done it before, I listened. I think we were greater listeners. I find that today's youth know everything, and they want to fix everything, and they want to do it their way. So there are listening exercises. There's a chapter that's also called Listen with Three Ears. So the two ears that are on the side of our head, as well as with your heart, your empathetic heart ear. So with listening, with eliminating the desire to be right and to answer the questions that I have and work through them, where you highlight situations you find yourself in when you want to be right, how's that working for you, and here are some additional alternate tools or suggestions for reshaping that path.
Yeah, and that was a chapter that I enjoyed as well, the listening with three ears. Now, you mentioned a little bit about right fighting. Again, I think that's a huge problem. I'd like to touch a little more on it because I think we're all guilty of it to a certain degree. I know that I am. I'm trying to think. There was a statement that somebody told me many years ago. I mean, you know, you can either choose to fight to be right or to fight to be kind and make a decision
right,
because you're not going to be both. And I try to remember that. I know that it doesn't mean that I'm able to do it every time. Talk a little bit about that on some of the ways, because I know it's really difficult when you know that you're right and there's this thing inside of us that wants to say, but, you know, I can't just, you know, let them think that something that isn't right is right, you know. That's the hard part when they're they're fighting for it, and you're going, I know that that's wrong, and I know that what I'm saying is right. I don't know. It's something in the way in which we're brought up. But you know, what's a good way that we can not? I mean, we can stop fighting to be right, but at the same time, not necessarily acknowledge that we're going to accept something that's wrong.
I'll tell you, my mentor, Mike Jones, phenomenal man, very wise. He shared this, I guess, suggestion with me, a way of framing the whole right fighting. He said, you know, we're raised, we're socialized, we have our way of doing things, our way of seeing things. Essentially, we have our maps, you know, and our maps shape us. He said, well, we got to realize that is our map is not everyone else's territory. Mm-hmm. We all have maps. So by me having my mindset or how I see something, even though it's right for me, it may not be right for that person. And who am I to say that this is going to be right for them? We haven't walked in their shoes for 40 years. So we can paint the picture and say, this is what's worked for me, and this is what I think would work for you. But ultimately, we all have our own choices. And we have to stop babysitting. We have to stop wanting to control. We have to do what we do and let that other person or that experience take shape for them. My ex-wife and I raised a little girl. She's 17 now. But I remember when we were all living under the same household, and I wanted to take my daughter back to my old neighborhood where I grew up in Philly. Lower class, slums, you know, terrible. And my ex-wife said, you know, just tell her about it. You don't have to take her there. I said, well, you have to feel it in order for it to stay with you. And she said, no, just read about it. So while we were together, I did not take her. When we divorced and I would get my daughter on weekends, Daddy, I want to see where you grew up. Say no more. We went back and the impact that had on her is what I wanted, because I wanted her to know that in order to be somebody, you have to be somebody, and you have to overcome your obstacles and not let them be your realities and your truths and the reasons or excuses for why you're not who you can be. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to see, I wanted her to see that experience. I wanted her to feel the fire.
Well,
and when we fight to be right all the time, we want to take that feeling away from somebody. Let them feel it. Let them do it. And let them then say, yeah, you were right.
Well, and I think that's a great example, because what you're talking about is, in this case, it has to do with something that's going to have a long-term effect on someone.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that also touches on my point, is when you and your ex were having this discussion, you know, you're probably feeling pretty passionate about the fact that the way that you think that she's going to gain the most out of this, meaning your daughter, is for it to be something that is very visual, that you're seeing it, you're feeling it. That's where I'm saying that's the hard part, because you're now explaining, look, but I'm really passionate about the fact that this is something that's going to help her long term. You had to apparently make a decision that, in this case, I'm not going to fight to be right. I'm going to be kind. But at the same time, you know, your daughter, at least for a short period of time, lost out. Or if you didn't get that opportunity again, your daughter lost out.
And I learned that a happy wife means a happy life. So I was thinking about that when I was in the midst of throwing my right fight haymakers. And she wasn't going to move off her point, and I wasn't going to move off my point. So you get to a place of, okay, what do we do now? What do we do now? And in the book, I encourage people to move off the right fight stool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, save the relationship, save the moment. Don't create a silent treatment marathon by, you know, disagreeing and staying in that place of disagreement. It's bigger than that. And we don't always have, we can be right, but still move away and get a greater relationship. Because a lot of times we're right and lonely. Okay, you're right. You won that. Now the entire organization is upset with you because you pull rank on them again. Come on. Like, let it go.
Mm-hmm.
So in the book I talk about, come on, let it go. Let it go. Because usually associated with being a right fighter, there's sarcasm, there's an autocratic style, there's an aggressive style, where people really don't want to be around you.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And it sounds like what you're saying is that in those moments, we're operating maybe too much out of pride and ego, or maybe even fear.
Yes.
So part of what you're saying is, let's figure out a way to move that into a level of accountability or responsibility, rather than sit back and be able to, in a lonely way, say, yeah, but I was right.
We're always keeping score. How many times have you been in a conversation with someone and you told them what they did, and before they understood what you were saying, they said, well, you do that too.
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. You won. You're right. I do that too. I do it all the time.
You got that right.
So it's the book is chock full of ways for you, as Michael Jackson once sang, to look in the mirror and see, what can I do differently? You know, what do I want to, is this all there is in life? There has to be more than, there has to be. And we make excuses to stay in Stuckville.
Yeah. Well, we have an instant message coming over, and this one reads, it says, when you have a culture where these problems seem to run all the way to the house on the hill in W. Sorry, it's the.
It's okay.
House on the hill in Washington, D.C. It's abbreviated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when you have a culture where these problems seem to run all the way to the house on the hill in Washington, D.C., and our kids are seeing that people do this with no conscience in every profession, how do we as parents actually counteract what I feel, as another person feels, it's an epidemic of the ends justify the means, or it doesn't matter what everyone else, because everyone else does it, type of society? It says, I don't mean to sound hopeless, but it feels that way sometimes. So
I think that's an excellent question. And again, I hope I don't disappoint or upset people with this, but I'm going there. You know, there's risk, there's reward. 4 years ago, President Barack Obama ran for office, and one of his slogans was, yes, we can. Yes, we can. The pronoun was we. I think a lot of us heard, yes, I can, mm-hmm. where they thought this one man was going to turn the world around. I don't think one man, Democrat, Republican, Independent, can do that. All of us have to play a role in changing or shifting our outcomes. I was raised in a single-parent family. I was raised in the ghetto. Actually, no, just the get. We couldn't even afford an O. It was the get. It was horrible. My mom made sure I attended kindergarten through 12th grade without missing a day of school. She said, sit in the front row. Raise your hand. Be somebody. Make a difference. So in spite of my circumstances, I still became someone who I believe is relatively successful and happy in doing what he wants to do in life. The noise, don't let the noise in. We can shape what our kids listen to. We can shape what they watch. We can be an incredible role model, teaching them through what we do right and what we do wrong. My dad, unfortunately, rest his soul. My dad was an alcoholic, but my dad taught me how to be a man through his mistakes, as well as through his marvelousness, because he was the original Mr. Energy, original charismatic, dancing, fun-loving guy. I got that part, and I also saw the other part as well. So I'm not looking to the folks on Capitol Hill. I'm not looking for the teachers. All those other people will help the growth. But I'm ultimately responsible as that parent to create an environment where we take responsibility for what happens to us. I don't think parents sit their children down every day and say, listen, if you don't get good grades in school, I want you to say it's the teacher's fault. If you ask me whose fault, it's the teacher's fault. No, it's your fault. It's your responsibility. So, yes, there's a lot of noise out there. And it's probably even more challenging than it was before, because the noise can come in electronically. It can come in through the TV, the computer, the Twitter, the text. But ultimately, we have to I'm old school. Drill sergeant tough to drill in what we want and to pray that it comes to fruition.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, I think the other thing that your parents must have instilled to you that I wish was instilled more is that willingness to give back, because you're not just doing this for you. That's why you have the books. That's why you have the seminars, is because you're showing it to other people. And I think that is huge, and I'm so glad that they did that.
You have to give back, and you have to be smart, and you have to consider who you're with. My mom used to always say, Jimmy, if you're the smartest person in your group of friends, it's time for a new group of friends. You know, iron sharpens iron. You want to be around people who are depositing in you, not withdrawing everything all the time.
Oh, that's a great – I like that one. I'm going to write that one down.
write them all down.
That's right.
We've got to think responsibility. And having written this book now, my excuse radar is up. My wife even said, you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself, because you can't make excuses anymore. Not even with me at home, because I'm going to call you on it. I'm like, okay, all right. No more excuses. No more it's the weather. It's the traffic. It's you name it, the plane. Yep. I gotta take responsibility.
Well, I want to jump back to one of the winning ways, and this was winning way number two, and it's one of the ones that I really focused on, which is focus on positive outcomes and expect success. So share with us, you know, why it's more than just writing a to-do list or setting goals.
Yeah, again, coming from my mentor, Mike Jones, he likes to say, focus on the outcome, FOTO, focus on the outcome. I added to that, focus on the outcome, photo, and expect success. I think we get what we expect, not what we want, not what we hope, not what we wish. It's ratcheting up that internal belief system and putting it out in the universe where I expect this to happen. And if I'm not expecting, then I'm hoping, I'm wishing, I'm thinking, and it doesn't feel powerful to me. So I'm expecting to have a good day. I'm going to expect to get that job. I'm going to expect to make a phenomenal presentation. I'm expecting the success. And Alan, this is really corny, but ask my wife. It happens all the time. I have parking angels, and wherever we go, I expect to get a parking spot that's right in front of Target, that's right in front of Wegmans, that's right in front of Whole Foods, that's right in front of the restaurant or the theater. And inevitably, invariably, when I pull up, I said, babe, there you go. Oh, boy, you're so lucky. It's been how long we've been together? 8, 9, 10 years. It's not lucky. I expect it to happen. And if it's not here, it's going to be across the street. And that's how I live my life. And even when things are not going well, I expect them to turn around quickly.
Yep.
So I'm not Mr. Pie in the Sky. I'm Mr. Take Life into My Own Hands, mentally, emotionally, physically, and look to create unreasonable outcomes for myself because everyone else is playing it safe. Alan, you probably like me. When you were younger, you did the hokey pokey. You put your right arm in and your left arm out and your right arm in and you shake it all about. The last thing you put in was your whole self. If we put our whole self into our life, our whole self, heart, mind, body, soul, every single day, no excuses.
Mm-hmm.
Living, playing, husbanding, parenting, full out.
Well,
and you want to see somebody play full out? Black Friday, Thanksgiving Eve, Thanksgiving night, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock. People are rushing to the stores to get discounts. Rush to your life. Rush to your goals. Rush to your outcomes. Because I've seen you do it. You step on people and kill them to get that DVD that's 50% off. Rush to your success. I know it's in you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like that. I like that. Now, for those of us that can get to that positive place, how do you stay in it with all the distractions, both home and business, that are out there? How do you get yourself to kind of stay there? Or if you do get pulled out of it for a little bit, how do we get back in quickly?
I'll give you a couple easy ways for people to do that. In my house, I have what I call a positive room. And in that room, I have my vision board, my motivational quotes on the wall. I have my diplomas. I have my magazines, things that pump me up. So when I'm going through it, I want to keep going through it. I want to keep going. I don't want to stay there. What's the quote? When you're going through it, keep going. I want to get out of it. So I have the positive storeroom. Number two, I have those positive people. My mentor group, mastermind group, there are people who I know I'll call. Number one, they're going to be surprised that I'm going through it, and I'm going to get their ears. And then I told them all the time, once you hear me going through it, I want you to ask me these eight words. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? So after you love me up and massage my shoulders and you say it's going to be all right, then shift it and say, Jim, what are you going to do about it? You cannot live a life and be 100% on top of your game every day. So when you are going through it, when you are emotional and vulnerable and you're not as you know, your wherewithal isn't there as it typically is, you have to have people that you can count on who have your best interests, not who will step on you. You have the readings. You have to have your vision board, your music. I have music that I play when I need it. I have enough ammunition that if I'm stuck in Negativeville for a month, I'm going to be okay because I have stuff that's going to bring me out of it.
I like that. We've got another instant message thing coming over, and we've only got a couple of minutes. But this one reads, what do you say to a person that feels that they accept so much responsibility that those around them seem to not take their own share of responsibility?
What are you going to do about it? You know the outcome. You know how that story is going to end. Move away. And if you cannot, because of level, because of income, because of relationship, if you cannot get that person to change, and 9 times out of 10, you're not going to be able to, you have to change how you show up. And I'll give you a quick example. My little guy, Ian, he's 6 years old. My little guy has autism. He's nonverbal. And for the first year or so of his life, he was talking, he was running, jumping, being the typical little boy. And then he moved to a place of keep to himself, not share, not talk. And it was diagnosed that he had autism. Well, I went to a pity party. Why me? I'm a speaker with a son who doesn't speak. He's not going to play ball with me with the kids outside. He's not even going to want to go outside. He's not going to want to do anything. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Woe is me. pity party. Well, my little guy, still nonverbal, but my little guy communicates with me nonverbally. He loves his iPad that has an autism activity on there where you can press what you want. I want the remote control. I want to eat. I want to go to bed. And he communicates that way. He jumps on me. He climbs on me. He plays with me. When did that change? When I showed up. Not him, because he's still autistic. Mm-hmm. But I had to shift how I showed up in that situation. So we have to stop looking for people to make changes. Stop waiting for them. Shift how we show up in any situation.
That is great. Now, I want everybody out there, if you want to make a change, again, you can go to the website, www.noexcuseguide.com. And Jim, do you have anything coming up, seminar speaking engagements coming up that is it listed on the site?
If they go to the noexcuseguide.com website, it's there. They can also go to the Jimpact. The name of my company is Jimpact Enterprises, J-I-M-P as in powerful, A-C-T as in terrific. My schedule is there. I'm in Utah next week. After that, I'll be in St. Louis. After that, I'll be in Baltimore. After that, I'll be in Virginia. The schedule is picking up tremendously. Baton Rouge, Louisiana in November. A lot's happening. A lot of people have a lot of energy around learning about this no excuse or this excuse-free life. I give out wristbands at my sessions, wristbands that say the No Excuse Club, because I want to develop a club for people around the world to live an excuse-free life and take personal responsibility for what happens to them and to others around them.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for coming on. When you get out to the West Coast, please let me know. I will make sure and not make any excuses so that I can be there. Fair enough.
Alan, I am going to let you know, I think I'm in Pleasanton, California in October, so I will let you know and keep doing what you do, fabulous at what you do, and keep changing lives.
Thank you. You too. All right. That concludes our show today. Again, you're listening to Answers, the numeral for the family. You can go to our blog, and if you were driving and you couldn't write down the No Excuse Guide, you can go to our blog. We'll have all of Jim's information. Jim, again, thank you very much, and we will look forward to all of you listening to us next week. Take care and have a great week.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk. Right here on LA Talk Radio.